joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Some counterinsurgency experts say al-Qaeda has been weakened by the war on terror begun by the Bush administration and continued by President Obama. Others say al-Qaeda and offshoots of the Muslim extremist group are growing stronger by the day. Joining me in the studio to talk about the ongoing threat of terrorism against the U.S., Juan Carlos Zarate of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Rudy Atala. He's a former counterterrorism expert for the Defense Department, and Christopher Bosek of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you all. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Diane. Happy
Thank
Year.
You. Let's talk about what each of you might expect to come out of today's meeting at the White House. Do you believe we'll see changes in policy? Juan Carlos.
Diane, I don't think initially you will see any dramatic shifts of policy out of this particular meeting. I think this meeting will be largely an after-action review for what happened in the case of Abdulmutallab. And it will be a chance for President Obama to both review as well as explain, excuse me, what is being done to tighten the watchlisting process so that you don't have an individual like this not appear on the no-fly list. You will also have a report from the Department of Homeland Security as to what's being done, in particular internationally, with respect to security procedures to make sure individuals are being screened, in particular from countries of interest, when coming to the U.S. But I think the big issue here, Diane, is where do we go from here with our counterterrorism policy? Especially given the fact that this threat was directed from al-Qaeda in Yemen, which presents a different paradigm from what we've seen in the past with plots emanating out of Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Juan Carlos Zarate, he's a senior advisor with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Rudy Atala, it seems as though we're playing catch-up.
I agree, Diane. We are playing catch up. I think what we're going to see probably is a big scrub of the various intel agencies, and we're going to we're in reactive mode basically right now. And once we scrub through, see where we missed the mark, then we'll probably regroup and try to rethink how the threat is growing, where it's going. You know, the focus is going to be right now on Yemen in the Horn of Africa region, but there are other parts of the world we need to be concerned about as well.
Do you believe that President Obama and the White House group can be proactive, and if so, how?
Well, absolutely, they can be proactive. I think what we need to do is take a look at not only the threat, as I said, in the Horn. We need to look at threats in North Africa, in the Sahel region, other parts of the world, to see exactly if other potential threats are coming our way, how to mitigate them, how to work closer with our allies and we really be factual about what's going on.
Rudy Atala, he's a retired lieutenant colonel, former director of Afric Counterterrorism in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Christopher Bosek, how do you see it? Will the focus be on how many countries we're concerned about, or how to find the individuals we may be concerned about?
Well, I think we'll probably see a combination of both. And I think if you look at the example of Yemen, it's going to be focusing on the al-Qaeda leaders and operatives that we know are in the country, plotting and planning operations within Yemen, into the region, into Saudi Arabia, and now even broader afield. And I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, al-Qaeda has always said what they want to do and always followed through on what they say they will do. So we've known for some time that there's a resurgent al-Qaeda organization in Yemen. We know that it's not just in Yemen. It's in a number of places, as Rudy outlined. And I think looking forward, you know, there will have to be more attention paid to the conditions that give rise to the issues of safe haven and refuge, which I think these organizations and affiliates seek out.
However, as we know, this young Somali man did not come from any kind of deprived background. He was someone who came from a wealthy Somali family. In fact, his father, a doctor, one of the most prominent physicians in his hometown. So, you know, the idea of initiating some kind of program to help these countries leaves me somewhat baffled when you're talking about individuals like him. Juan Carlos?
Diane, I think that's right, and I think Abdul Muttalib falls in a long line of the privileged terrorists that we've seen in the past. In fact, in the line of engineers, he's an engineering student. We've seen Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others who are engineers and privileged in terms of both education and background. But I think Christopher's point about physical safe haven is an important one. We have to focus on the individuals who are clearly being radicalized and drawn to the terrorist groups. But we also cannot forget that al-Qaeda relies very heavily on physical safe havens, physical geography, areas of the world where they have the ability to set up shop, train, have people come in, plot together. That's really been the problem, frankly, in western Pakistan over the last 4 or 5 years. It was the problem of Afghanistan prior to 9/11, and it's the problem that's starting to emerge in Yemen, and certainly we've seen indications of this in Somalia before the Ethiopians invaded in 2006 and still today. And I think what both Rudy and Christopher have said are exactly right. We've got to worry about those parts of the world where al-Qaeda has been able to find physical safe haven, despite the fact that there is a problem on the internet as well. Mm-hmm. But we cannot forget the physical spaces that al-Qaeda relies on to plot these very strategic and important plots.
And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850, send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You've talked about Pakistan. You've talked about Yemen. We know about Somalia, Afghanistan. Why is Cuba on this new list of potential terrorist groups or potential terrorist threats? How do we answer that, Juan Carlos?
Well, you're hitting a sore point, because I used to be part of the Treasury Department, used to lead it and led the sanctions on Cuba and some of these other countries. Cuba has been a longstanding part of the list of state sponsors of terror. And I think what the government has done here is to put together a list of both the state sponsors of terror plus other countries of interest like Algeria, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, to put together a comprehensive list. In the context of al-Qaeda, frankly, Cuba doesn't make a lot of sense. That said, Diane, I would caution against looking away from the Western Hemisphere. I think one of the problems we've seen emerging recently has been the growing ties between Venezuela and Iran and Syria, travel directly between those countries, indications of Hezbollah presence in Venezuela. And so I don't think we should be myopic in terms of looking at, and as you said, reactive, the last threat. We need to be looking comprehensively at where we have terrorist individuals possibly transiting countries, including in the Western Hemisphere.
So you believe that this is the first I've heard of Hezbollah in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. What about that, Rudy?
Oh, absolutely. Hezbollah's been in Latin America for a very long time. They're in Mexico. I mean, they're involved with the drug cartels. You have Hezbollah branches in parts of Europe, all over West Africa, Central Africa. They're everywhere, and I think I think that's the 800-pound gorilla in the room too. Everybody's so focused on Al-Qaeda because their, you know, their attacks are so big, and they're constantly in the front lines. But Iran is, and Quds forces are out there making headway, pushing on Hezbollah, just in case in the future something happens, they can respond. And that's also a threat that we really need to look at very closely.
Tell me about the Al-Qaeda threat in North Africa and Europe.
Well, Al-Qaeda in the land of Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM, is in December 2007... conducted an attack against a UN building and a justice building in Algiers. They are directly linked to some of the very large North African communities in Europe. Example is in France, you have over 1 million North Africans living there. Some ties to AQIM. Recently, there have been some arrests in Italy and Spain. Over the past year in France as well, and in 07 of funding from Europe to AQIM so they can continue conducting attacks. They have a rear base in northern Mali. They've kidnapped and killed a UK citizen in May of 09. They killed an American citizen in Mauritania in June of 09. They were responsible for killing four French tourists in 08. So they're very active, and I think something we need to pay attention to.
Rudy Atella, he worked in the Africa counterterrorism policy in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. We'll take a short break. We do invite your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. As we talk about the threat of terrorism coming to this country from other areas around the world, certainly other groups in addition to Al-Qaeda, if you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Christopher Bosick, tell us more about Al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Well, just about a year ago, January of 2009, the Saudi and the Yemeni affiliates of Al-Qaeda emerged into this organization we now call Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, with a larger regional focus. And this is the result of several factors. First, there are a number of things going on in Yemen that give rise to this. There has been an Al-Qaeda presence in the country for a long time. There's a long history of religious and social conservatism, but also Islamic militancy. Also, as conditions in Saudi Arabia became less permissive and as the Saudis cracked down more and more on terrorists, they fled to Yemen. And Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia instructed its members to flee to Yemen to make use of the safe haven to plot and plan operations. So you have Yemenis and Saudis, as well as other third country nationals, who are hiding out in Yemen, engaged in this. And over the past year, we've seen a number of incidents and attacks. So there were Yemeni security officials assassinated. Yemeni security officials have been abducted and murdered and executed. The Saudis intercepted 35 suicide vests coming into the country in April of last year. You know, and that's worrisome for a lot of reasons, because suicide vests aren't something you stockpile for a rainy day. You make them to use them. And it suggests that there's a dedicated network of bomb makers in the country, a support infrastructure, and the belief that there are Saudis inside the kingdom ready to use these.
Describe these suicide vests for me.
So they were the components for about 30 to 35 suicide vests that were caught coming across the border with a group of 11 infiltrators. Again, in October of this year, there were two Saudis that were killed crossing the border into Jizan province in the south. One was a Guantanamo returnee, the brother-in-law of Saad al-Shishri, who was the deputy commander of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. These two were bringing with them four or five suicide vests, and they were being met by a Yemeni inside the kingdom. There was also, in August, a suicide attempt, a bomb attack against Prince Mohammed bin Naif, the Saudi counterterrorism chief, which eerily is similar to the attack that we saw on Christmas Day in terms of the chemicals used and the tactics used.
Why was the U.S. and the Embassy of Great Britain closed for 2 days, Juan Carlos?
Well, the counterterrorism community and the intelligence community had information that there were direct threats to the U.S. Embassy as well as the British Embassy. And so out of precaution, they closed the embassy. There's a great deal of security around the embassy already. Recall that in September of 08, our embassy was attacked already by al-Qaeda members in the country. And so we were already at a heightened state of alert and security in the country. And so when American officials announced that we were closing the embassy, that suggested an even more serious and direct threat and suggested something was imminent. And that's why we saw, I think, the Yemeni government taking some action. Some arrests were announced in Sana'a, the capital. And I think it will precipitate even more measures by the Yemeni government, both in the capital and in the hinterlands, to go after al-Qaeda members who are known.
It's certainly interesting that our focus on Yemen has sort of gone up and down, in and out, depending on exactly what was happening in Yemen, Chris.
Well, I think, you know, for a long time, the U.S.-Yemeni relationship has been all about security. And that's been the issue that all other issues were subservient to, which is not necessarily in the long-term interest of either country. And I think the Yemenis often felt that they were getting the short end of the stick, that for the Yemenis, I think they kind of look at international partners and kind of think, how big is your checkbook and what are you going to do for me now? In a country that's as desperately poor as it is. So I think that's one thing. But I think also, you know, 12 months ago, it was probably very difficult to talk about Yemen and Washington. I mean, with all the other issues that this administration is coming in to focus on, two ongoing wars, Iran, North Korea, banking crisis, global financial meltdown, healthcare, pandemic flu, Yemen was really far on the list. I think that's been changing, you know, over the last 6 months, for sure. I think more attention is paid to Yemen. In the last month preceding the December 17th airstrikes in Yemen, I think Yemen was getting a lot more attention. I think people realize that, you know, we've seen this movie before and we know how it ends.
Now, certainly the Christmas Day attempt brought the whole issue of U.S. security once again into great focus. Our first emailer says what's on everybody's mind is from Carolina in Crystal City. Israel has been dealing with terrorism in the sky for a long, long time. What do they do to ensure safety? Are we willing and able to do the same? Rudy.
Oh, sure. Israel takes extreme precautions. Whenever people purchase tickets, they look at whether the person purchased it with a credit card or with cash. That would separate people in line. If you purchase your tickets with cash, that certainly requires additional questioning. If a person's not traveling with bags and is paid for, you know, for their tickets with cash, like we have in the case of Abu Muttalib, you know, that should raise a lot of flags. So Israelis take extreme precautions in those areas, and they're fairly thorough with their checks of people
A lot of profiling going on, is there not, Juan Carlos?
That's absolutely exactly right. The Israelis apply a layered defense focused heavily on intelligence, vetting of individuals, and the use of behavioral analysts to look at individuals in airports. And it takes a lot of time to get through Israeli security.
What do you mean, behavioral analysts?
That means people literally sitting in the airports at Ben-Gurion or at other sites at El Al ticket counters, looking to see if individuals are acting normally, the way they should. Do they fit a particular mm-hmm. profile? Mm-hmm. This is something actually that the U.S. has emulated to a certain extent after 9/11. We looked at Israeli security. We built a model of layered defense. The difference, though, the primary difference between Israel and the U.S. is volume. Israel has one major airport to defend against or through. Ticket counters around the world, no doubt, but much less volume. Our challenge is, how do you move commercial traffic in and out of the U.S. safely, securely, without affecting commercial interests and privacy interests? And that's a different balance in the U.S. than it is in Israel.
Now, with that issue of privacy, the whole question of body scanning has arisen. Does Israel use body scanners?
I don't know the answer to that one.
I'm not sure either, Diane. They may selectively now, but they have not relied on that. They rely on personal contact. They look every passenger in the eye. They check bags. They pat down if necessary. Some of the procedures you're seeing now on inbound flights into the U.S., the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, is applying precisely the things the Israelis do. But we're doing it in limited ways. The Israelis do it all the time.
Mm-hmm. All the time, meaning that every single passenger that comes through that airport, carefully screened, background is known, but there is that profiling going on. So does that mean certain Arabs are targeted? Does that mean now certain Yemenis would be targeted, Chris?
I mean, I think just from my own experience in Israel, you see that, you know, Palestinian travelers get more attention than Israeli travelers. I think that's a big part of this. I think this profiling, you know, also the fact that you turn in your carry-on baggage, you know, at the ticket counter. I think there are all kinds of steps that El Al does in different airports to increase their security. So, I mean, you show up at the airport earlier. And I think the fact that the state is undercutting and underwriting all of this is really important, right? So, I mean, El Al as a government airline can afford to do this. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think if you told United and American and everybody else they had to do this too, that would be a big burden, I would think, for some of these airlines.
Do you think there is going to be a move toward greater screening? When you say they turn in their carry-on luggage at the counter, what does that mean? They do not take carry-on luggage?
And then at the gate, you collect your carry-on bag after they've gone through everything and swiped
everything.
So they've gone
through everything.
Right.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Do you think we're moving in that direction?
We may, Diana. And I think what you're seeing now with the security enhancements is geographic profiling. Which is to say, people coming from or through countries of interest where we are not comfortable with the security in those countries, or where we suspect Al-Qaeda has a presence and may be using those facilities to get to the U.S., we're going to start seeing more and more geographic profiling.
Where do you believe that the U.S. should focus the majority of its anti-terrorism efforts, Chris?
Well, I think there's the immediate kind of killer capture, the violent, you know, military direct action that needs to happen. But that should be a small component of an overall larger counterterrorism strategy. So if we're taking the example of Yemen, going after, you know, the leadership elements that we know are in the country and the operatives are there is key. But also you need to back that up with lots of long-term efforts because, you know, Yemen has a failing economy. They're running out of water, 35% unemployment. I mean, there are so many problems in Yemen that give rise to the conditions that fuel Al-Qaeda militancy. And this is not just going on in Yemen. I think Rudy and Juan make these great points. It's Mauritania and Tajikistan. And we can find these countries all over the world where the state's authority is slowly eroding. And it's those undergoverned spaces in between that we need to be concerned about.
Exactly.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think if you look at, in particular, in the Horn of Africa, as Rudy mentioned earlier, you've got problems not just of potential al-Qaeda affiliates there, the al-Shabaab movement, known al-Qaeda affiliates since the 90s there, but you've got other problems like piracy that emerge from these safe havens, drug smuggling. Rudy was talking about al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. The DEA just unsealed an indictment alleging that al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is engaged in drug trafficking from the Western Hemisphere up through West Africa into Europe. And so these safe havens present all sorts of international security issues, and we've got to find new and creative ways of dealing with them. And I think in the context of countries like Yemen, we've got to find a way of enlisting the countries that have great interests, like Saudi Arabia, to deal with the problems that are in their own backyard.
What's the connection between the attacks that we are seeing and the people who have been repatriated from Guantanamo to Yemen? President Bush let 14 people go back there. Now President Obama has let 7 return.
You know, I think if you want to solve the issue of Guantanamo or deal with the issue of Guantanamo, you need to deal with the issue of the Yemeni detainees. They're the largest single national group there. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of concern about sending Yemeni detainees back to a country where we have no idea what's going to happen to them.
Does Yemen want these people?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I think the President Saleh, I think, can speak, you know, very forcefully now about why he wants these individuals to come back. But it's much stronger if they don't come back. Because as soon as they get sent back to Yemen, who knows what's going to happen to them? They don't have a program to facilitate the return into society. And the Yemeni government's going to put them in prison. And as soon as they do, their family and tribes are going to say, why are you holding these guys in prison when the Americans let them go? If the Americans don't think they're dangerous, you should let them out. And that's not what we want to see happen.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones, hear what our listeners' concerns are. 800-433-8850. First to Elaine in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was very concerned when we're talking about all of these extra procedures we're going to be going through, scanning, et cetera. I have no problem with that. What I have a problem with is I read in the New York Times and that this guy that tried to blow up the airplane got on the plane at Schiphol in the Netherlands without a passport. How did that happen? Can anyone answer that? Is anyone being held accountable for that? Or is that one of those urban myths that we hear? Thank you.
Without a passport seems rather unlikely, but...
That's not a fact or data point that I've heard, and so it may be one of these urban myths that's emerging about the laxity with respect to the security on this individual.
He did have a visa.
He had a visa, and that visa would have been attached to the passport more than likely, and he would not have been allowed through...
Without a visa
and without a passport. That seems very unlikely.
Right.
We'll see what the review indicates, but yeah. I think that's probably urban legend at this
point. Rudy?
No, I agree with Juan. That's exactly right. I mean, urban legends start flying all the time in situations like this. Schiphol Airport, they do take some precautionary measures, especially people coming stateside. Obviously, something failed and this guy got through, but... passports, first thing they do check.
All right. Let's go to Gainesville, Florida. Good morning, Noah. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Good
morning.
I wanted to ask your guests whether they could discuss the drawbacks to pursuing a what I might describe as the more commando approach to dealing with terrorism. As our counterterrorism strategy, instead of positioning large groups of U.S. military personnel in single locations and trying to wage attacks on a problem that seems to spread around.
Now, let me ask, are you talking specifically about one country or are you speaking generally?
I'm speaking generally, but I mean, I think obviously I'd be talking about first Iraq and now Afghanistan, and wondering how positioning large groups of people in one place helps us deal with remaining safe, because it seems to me that that's probably the majority's concern in this country.
Juan Carlos.
Well, I think that the tendency, especially in dealing with problems like in Yemen or in Somalia, is to use special forces, to not have a major U.S. military footprint. The problem in Afghanistan is that we're in there. We invaded after 9/11 to disrupt the al-Qaeda safe haven that was there, the training camps to dislodge the Taliban. And so in a sense, it's difficult to sort of pull out without doing great damage to the stability of what's happening in Afghanistan. But we've got a choice with Yemen and Somalia. We're not going to put major brigades there. What we're going to be doing is supporting the locals there and likely having special forces do the heavy lifting, if at all.
Do we really have a number for those who pose a threat to the United States? Yesterday on this program, Jessica Matthews said the total number of these individuals may be around 300. Is that your understanding, Chris?
I think in Yemen, I think when you speak with security officials, I think they'll say they're concerned about several hundred cells or operatives inside Yemen, which, you know, in a country of 23 million may be pretty small, but it's still a significant number.
Christopher Bosick of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
China may soon challenge the U.S. as the sole global superpower. This year, it will become the world's second largest economy. An inside look at how China is creating a new social and economic model and what it means for the West. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back to our discussion of terrorism around the world, what the U.S. can do, what will come out of this meeting at the White House today. Juan Carlos, during the break, I was asking you what further measures you believe will be required to try to identify individuals, both coming into this country and perhaps already here, who try to travel and perhaps disrupt and destroy airline traffic here in the United States.
Well, Diane, in the first instance, I think you'll start to see more of what we've already heard about: deployment of body scan technology, more pat-downs, more targeting of travelers coming in and out of suspect countries. But I think in the long term, what we're probably going to be looking at is a biometric-based system. That is to say, our current watchlist system and no-fly system is a name-based system. And so it relies on individuals actually using their true name, our ability to actually identify them and have their name. In this case, we did, fortunately. It's a good case scenario. We actually had his name. Unfortunately, it didn't get vetted properly. But, you know, the worst case scenario is actually smart operatives not using their names, who aren't on our radar screen, using clean passports, not indicating that they've traveled to Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia, and they get onto an airline or into the country. And I think when officials look at this problem, they're going to say the long-term solution to this is actually using things like fingerprint, iris scanning, even voice identification and other biometrics that are useful and things that cannot change and that identify individuals.
Is any country now using biometrics?
Yes. For example, the United Arab Emirates uses retinal scans for people moving in and out of the UAE. They've been actually on the forefront of that. The U.S. government, under the prior administration, started under the U.S. visit program the fingerprinting of individuals coming in. There was a lot of uproar about that, if you recall, Diane. But that was part of a process of starting a biometric baseline of people moving in and out of the country. And so you've seen this in countries around the world where people are playing with new technologies to capture things like fingerprint and iris scans.
Now, is that going to be selective, or is that going to be, in your view, for everyone who moves through an airport? Rudy?
I think it should be for everyone that moves through airport. And I know people don't like that. It's almost an invasion of privacy for some folks. But I think that's exactly what Juan said. It's going to be an important factor for us in the long run. And it makes security a lot more tolerable at the airport. TSA uses something called Global Entry now. If you do register, it takes time. You go in for an interview. They'll do a finger scan. They scan your passport, match you up, so you can go through the lines a lot faster. They're trying to implement that in other countries. It's $100 for the year. I think some people would rather go through that than going through the hassle. So there are some measures out there. I think we just need to beef that up.
Now, what about the kind of – you mentioned – Juan Carlos, that this young man used his name. Suppose you had someone using a different name who was not on any list, who had explosives in a body cavity, and was scanned. Is that going to show up?
Well, I think it will be difficult. Depends on the technology used. But I think if it's something ingested or placed in a body cavity, it will be more difficult to detect. That's why, Diane, you need a combination of both intelligence and screening to make sure that we are secure. And I think that's what's going to come out of the review today, which is how are we ensuring that we are getting the right intelligence in the right hands to vet people getting onto planes headed for the U.S., and how are we screening so that we can account for these new and unfortunately quite innovative ways of trying to get explosives or other devices onto planes.
All right, let's take a caller in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Adam. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just traveled from Israel to JFK, New York City, on December 28th. And going through security in Israel was very nonchalant. They asked questions, where were you coming from? Did you enjoy your trip? Who are you traveling with? And in fact, I saw people from all races and creeds traveling through that airport as well. But as soon as I arrived to JFK and went through security, they were using technology and they were very abrupt and didn't even ask a single question to any passengers. That's my comment. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Any comment, Rudy?
Like we said earlier, and Juan alluded to it, Israel's been doing this for a long time. They're pretty much experts in this field. I think what we're seeing right now is we're reacting to this situation, and until the dust settles, it's gonna be chaotic.
Here's an email from Phil, who says, are Arab nations recruiting their own citizen spies to find al-Qaeda leaders or break up plots? If al-Qaeda acquires a WMD, shouldn't nations like Russia, China, and India also be worried because it might be used against them in support of Muslim minorities? What are these other nations doing to break up al-Qaeda? Christopher Bosick.
Well, I think you can take the example of Saudi Arabia, where they have a very comprehensive counterterrorism approach that involves, you know, military and security and intelligence measures, but also involves a much softer approach where there's a very well-developed public communications information program to explain to the public that extremists and terrorists don't operate in your interest, that the government is a victim of terrorism too, and that we're on your side. There's also a very well-developed program to disengage people from militancy and terrorism. So,
tell me about that program.
So it's a program that's targeted at people that either get arrested inside the country on domestic security offenses, or that try to go abroad to Afghanistan or Iraq, or that come back from Guantanamo. And basically, just as people engage in radicalism or militancy, there's research to show you can disengage. Not everybody does. Not everybody will leave terrorism, but there are some people who do. So these programs are targeted to people that have not yet fully made up their minds.
And what are the incentives?
So there's first intensive religious discussion and dialogue to explain to you and get you to draw out why you think your actions are justified on your understanding of Islam, and then scholars and sheikhs try to present contrary evidence to you. You also get extensive social support while you're in custody. So the government provides for your family and stuff, gives you a car and a salary and a job once you leave. And also when you get released, your family is given a pretty direct message of responsibility that if you get in trouble, your family members will be held accountable. So it uses social pressure and family honor to keep people in line. And, you know, it's not a perfect program. You know,
we know how well it's worked?
Well, for Guantanamo returnees, it's about 80% successful. There are 120 Saudi nationals that have been repatriated from Guantanamo. And of those, 26 are either in custody, wanted, or have been killed in security incidents. So if you compare that to a federal prison or a mental health facility, it's better. And I think what this shows is that when people leave custodial situations, if you don't provide any support for them, you almost guarantee they'll return to their previous mode of behavior. So you need to provide people options.
Juan Carlos.
Yeah, and this is a phenomenon that's been happening around the world. Countries like Singapore, Malaysia, other countries have their own versions of de-radicalization and rehabilitation programs. A lot of scholars have looked at this. I think it's important to note that you've got different modes of radicalization. And so these programs don't necessarily work in all cases. And I think one of the things that we've got to be careful of is we have viewed the Saudi rehabilitation program as somewhat of the silver bullet here. And it hasn't been wholly. The recidivism rate has been low, no doubt, but the people who've escaped from it or who have gone back to their prior ways have turned out to be violent and, in fact, have returned to Yemen to form part of this al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
Because there is a safe haven.
There is a safe haven there, and they've returned to their ways. And, frankly, they probably weren't convinced by the religious counter-arguments presented to them, et cetera. So it's not a failsafe, but it's an important model to look at, especially as we talk about how to deal with holding these guys and reforming them in the long term.
Are there other areas of the world in which this kind of trying to rehabilitate people is happening?
Well, I think, as Juan points out, these programs have spread, you know, throughout the Arab and Muslim world. And just about every national counterterrorism strategy has a rehabilitation component.
Have to identify those who are behaving in an extreme way before you can rehabilitate them.
Sure. And I think Juan makes this really key point, that there are lots of different pathways with which people get into this.
Yeah.
So understanding how someone got into this mode of behavior helps tell you something about how to get them out. People who are religiously motivated may benefit from religious discussion. If you got into this through criminality or drugs or bad social networks, you need different help. So it's part of understanding how you moved into it to how to get people out of it.
Rudy.
I think there's only one very weak point that I think needs to be addressed even further. It's radicalization happens a lot in prisons. because you have a captive audience. And in some cases, we don't put enough effort or, I think, resources into helping some of these countries in this area. Another point is I'll just bring up Morocco. Morocco felt a while back, the king, that many folks were being radicalized outside of the borders of their country. So at one point, he sent 74 imams that were well-trained into Europe and North America to preach in the mosques more tolerism and to also reach out that group of people that may be radicalized.
Here's an email from Barry, who says, is there a point at which security measures and procedures become so onerous it will hinder the free trade of goods and services and even tourism? What do you think, Juan Carlos?
I think so, Diane, and I think one of the things that the president will likely be calculating as he hears this is the balance between security and commercial interests and privacy interests, frankly. You know, there's a point at which we may have to just, you know, take certain risks.
The risk.
To still survive as an open, free, and commercially viable society. And I think we've got to be open with each other about that there are certain things that we may not want to do from a security perspective to everybody at all times because it will be just too onerous. One other thing I would mention, Diane, one of the things the administration is going to have to think about is the potential for blowback, not only internally with respect to people not liking these onerous security measures, but with our friends and allies abroad. One of the things the Bush administration had to deal a lot with was complaints from allies, Pakistanis, Saudi Arabians, of security measures coming into the country. It's something that the Obama administration now is probably going to have to deal with and may start to erode some of the goodwill that he has tried to create, especially in Muslim-majority countries.
Do you agree, Chris?
Oh, absolutely. I know every time I'm in Saudi Arabia, I have people complain to me about experiences they've had in American airports.
Like what?
Oh, people who get, they feel they're being harassed in front of their wives or their children, and they don't like how that makes them feel. I've had officials actually tell me that they've missed flights because they've been delayed. They've had questions about how much cash they're carrying. And I think a lot of Saudis, you know, oftentimes will tell me that they don't want to come to the United States. Or they don't want to send their kid to the United States anymore. So I think it's a huge problem. And I'm sure that these travel measures will increase that.
Christopher Bosek is at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Brett. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, your guest said earlier that the administration was being proactive and they're talking to coalition partners. And I would put forth that we have a terrorist in custody right now who could tell us where he was trained, who else they're training, and what other people are coming over to do that. He said there's hundreds lined up to do that. And he was talking, but the administration then gave him a lawyer, read him his Miranda rights, and the lawyer told him to be quiet. And now the administration is having to negotiate with this guy, plea bargaining, as they described it, offering him a reduced prison sentence if he'd only talked to us. If you're being proactive, you would have turned the guy over to military authority. And see, the administration doesn't realize we're at war with people who don't have a country. This is not a civil matter. We're at war, and they still treat it like a civil matter. So I would say they're not being proactive.
Brett,
number one goal seems to be to close Guantanamo.
Thanks for calling, Brett. The controversy over the decision to take this man into civil custody as opposed to putting him before a military commission has raised so many questions, Juan.
I think that's right. I think this case is fascinating because it has emerged a lot of the problems that the administration's having in terms of defining how they look at the problem. In the first instance, is this going to be a war-like scenario and paradigm? And do you have intelligence and prevention as the primary purpose of our activities, or is it to hold people accountable in the criminal justice system? They are two different things, and you can do both, but you've got to decide which you want to do first. And I think this administration, though talks about being at war with al-Qaeda, is still not fully resolved as to how they want to deal with it in concrete.
If this had been your decision, how would you have handled it?
I think we would have done what we did with Jose Padilla, which was to put him into the military context first, get as much information about him. Jose Padilla, recall, had information about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, plots against apartments in Chicago, perhaps a dirty bomb. And then after we had gotten enough intelligence out of him, build the criminal case and then convict him.
How do we know we haven't already gotten the information we needed from this young man before we turned him over to an attorney and read him his Miranda rights? Perhaps that's exactly what was done.
Well, it's never clear. I think you've got to keep talking to the individual. And the fact that he was talking to officials before he had a lawyer is a cautionary tale about giving him a lawyer too soon, because I think we want to learn as much as we can about who his associates are, what's happening in Yemen, and what he was doing in terms of trying to blow up a plane.
Lots of questions remain. Thank you all for being here. Juan Carlos Zarate, Rudy Atala, and Christopher Bosek. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from